Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Wednesday, August 8th, 2012, everyone. Welcome to Help for HD News Channel. This is Melissa Biliardi, your host. Call in today on 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. Please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD News Channel and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming news. You may also listen to the show right from your iPhones and Androids. 20,300 listeners now. Thank you, amazing listeners. Tonight we may have a little bit of a short show, but we'll see how it all goes. Huntington's disease, HD, is a fatal genetic brain disease, autosomal dominant gene mutation on chromosome 4. That means it does not skip generations. Children of an HD parent have a 50-50 chance of inheriting the gene mutation. Juvenile Huntington's disease, JHD, is more virulent and devastating with seizures, dystonia, and many other horrible and painful manifestations. Genetic testing is usually considered when a person presents with family history and symptoms, which could be psychiatric, cognitive, or movement disorders. Although a small percent of spontaneous cases do occur, about 1 in 10,000 people in the USA have HD, with another 150,000 at risk. If that's true in the rest of the world, that's about 1.4 million people that have HD, and about 10%, 5 to 10% of the HD population are juvenile Huntington's. Now, in direct response to Monday's show with Dr. LaVon Goodman, and information disseminated by the AAN, that's the American Academy of Neurology, Guidelines for Treating Chorea and Huntington's, by the HDSA, Melissa Armstrong, MD, MSc, and Gary Gronseth, MD, FAAN, are here today to explain how the AAN clinical practice guideline process works to deliver the best evidence-based recommendations to physicians who are treating for neurologic disorders, in particular chorea and Huntington's. For more information about the American Academy of Neurology, visit AAN.com. We are honored, delighted, and thrilled to have the prestigious American Academy of Neurology here with us tonight. And Gary S. Gronseth, MD, FAAN, is a professor of neurology at University of Kansas, and he is the evidence-based medicine methodologist for the American Academy of Neurology. Dr. Melissa Armstrong, is an assistant professor of neurology at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and she's also fellowship trained in movement disorders. She is also participates in the medical research and has been involved in guideline development for the American Academy of Neurology since 2006. So I want to welcome both of you. Hello, Dr. Gronseth and Dr. Armstrong. How are you tonight?
Good, thank you.
It's great to have you on the show.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, so Dr. Gronseth, could you tell us a little bit more about your role as the evidence-based methodologist at AAN? What is that?
So I guess we should start then with a definition of evidence-based medicine. And what we try to do when we're doing evidence-based medicine is answer the question, what do we really know about what works and what doesn't work when we take care of patients? That's not an easy question to answer oftentimes, but we do know from a lot of other studies that have been done about what type of evidence gives us a great confidence that an intervention, for example, for chorea works, and what type of evidence doesn't give us great confidence that it works. So in a nutshell, that's what evidence-based medicine is about. Now, there are a lot of details in terms about of how we go about trying to answer a question like that. And it follows a multi-step process. First, we answer a very specific question. So for patients with a certain condition, what drugs, for example, help alleviate some of their symptoms? And then we attempt to find all of the evidence that's published about that condition. And we try to find out what actually happened to patients with that disease when they were treated with that medication. Did they get better? Did they not get better? Did they have side effects? Were these side effects severe? Were they temporary? And so we look for all of the published studies. And then the next thing that we do, and this is one of the key features of evidence-based medicine, is when we find the studies, we rate them on a hierarchy based on how well-designed and how well-executed they were. And so there are some studies that are very well done, and we have a lot of confidence in the results that they give. And then there are other studies that aren't so well done. So we rate them on this hierarchy. And then we ask what they showed. Did the medication work? Did it not work? Did it have side effects or not? And then we put practice recommendations based upon what we found.
Okay, and that is your practice guidelines.
That's right.
Right. Now, talk about analytical process. I'm sure you have formulas and all kinds of different scientific methods to rate these studies. How long does it take you to put together a guideline such as this?
So it depends on the scope of the guideline. So we have some guidelines that ask lots and lots of questions. So, for example, we have a guideline on Parkinson's disease, and we asked lots and lots of questions, and that took 4 years to do. And then we do more focused guidelines where we ask very specific questions. This one is somewhat in between, and I think Dr. Armstrong could tell us how long it took to do this. She was certainly more involved with that, but this was sort of a middle-of-the-road kind of guideline.
Okay, now you did talk about your evidence, and I'm particularly interested in what kind of evidence is obtained. You talked about studies. Now, is this clinical trials and clinical studies that you're obtaining for the evidence?
Right. These are clinical studies that have been published, and so we can actually look at how they were done. And then, in general, the best trials are randomized controlled trials. These have the lowest risk of bias, meaning that they're the most likely to give us a correct answer about the effectiveness and safety of a treatment. But then there are also lesser quality studies that we have less confidence in, but that they still provide some useful information, including what we would call a case series, a study where everyone gets the same treatment.
Mm-hmm. Now, with Huntington's disease, you probably don't have a great number of articles that are published. Does that present a problem in discovering this evidence?
So that's a problem with virtually all of the guidelines that we do. There's never enough evidence. There's never enough high-quality evidence that we would like. It's never ideal. And so we're never able to make as strong of recommendations or be as definitive as we would like. And that's particularly true for, diseases that are less common than other diseases. And so if you compared the prevalence of Parkinson's disease to Huntington's disease, you would expect and, of course, find that there's more studies done on Parkinson's disease than Huntington's disease, and we certainly wish that we had more.
Right. Hopefully that will happen soon. So in gathering your evidence, you then come up with a guideline, and before it's published, you send it out to peer review, or how do other people give you their input? Other physicians and organizations give you their input?
So we do that at several stages. So the first stage is that we have a broad review network. This consists of neurologists and oftentimes other specialties. And so it literally goes, it can go to 60, 70, 100 different individual physicians to review, and they all give us input about it. And the guideline authors are actually required to respond to every single suggestion. Not the guideline isn't always changed in response to the input that we get, but oftentimes it is, and oftentimes the input is very useful, but we always respond. There's a committee within the academy that consists of a broad range of neurologists, and many of them actually have some expertise in evidence-based medicine, and they also review the guideline. And then there are supervising committees over that. There's a practice committee consisting of neurologists, and they give input. And then when the guideline goes to the Journal of Neurology, it goes through a standard peer-reviewed process where other neurologists look at the guideline. So these things, these guidelines, they get looked at by lots of different people.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you go outside the AAN for this process, or do you only stay within your AAN physicians and network?
So we do go outside the AAN. Oftentimes that's done later on in the process when we look for endorsement. That's how we send it to the Huntington's Disease Society and asking for endorsement, and that's when they gave their opinion about the guideline.
Okay. Now, speaking of that, they did publish a letter on their website, and the actual, I don't know if it's the actual guideline, but it is a guideline of what we're talking, what we're referring to. And it didn't seem like they were in agreement with your finding. Is that a matter of semantics, or is this normal to have a disagreement about a guideline like this?
So it's certainly not unusual for there to be some disagreement, and the usual case is that the evidence that's available tells us one thing, and the experience of the experts in the field may tell us something somewhat different. When we write the guideline, it's an evidence-based guideline, we follow the evidence. Certainly, we acknowledge opinions and common practice, but we don't go beyond what the evidence says. Although we don't discount the value of expert opinion, there's certainly lots of venues where the experts write articles and write their own expert opinion-based guidelines, so that neurologists and patients and families can be exposed to that opinion. But oftentimes it's because of the way we come at the problem. We're both interested in trying to find the best solution to help patients. But when you come at it from a strictly evidence-based standpoint, this is the strongest evidence, this is the best evidence, this evidence has the least risk of bias, versus coming at it from the standpoint, well, I'm an expert and I have a lot of experience with this, sometimes you come up with different differences or different answers. And those differences oftentimes point to the need for more research, more studies that need to be done to tell us what the real answer is.
Okay. Now, one of the comments that was made on the show on Monday by Dr. Goodman was that it seemed as though there was not a, I think she called it real-world patient, I can't even think of the way she termed it, but she used the phrase real-world patient was not considered. And she was concerned about the word should being used in prescribing tetrabenazine instead of may or possibly, I don't know what the problem was. Could you address that? I mean, are you...
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, certainly. And I actually listened to the interview and thought that Dr. Goodman made very many excellent points. I think these points we also made in the full version of the document. But number one is you can never take a guideline. You can never take evidence from any study, and it never applies perfectly to the patient in front of you. You always have to individualize that, and in the guideline, we believe that we emphasize that, and in other materials that accompany the guideline, educational materials that are designed for physicians and for patients, we also emphasize that. So we agree with that completely. Then the second point is about should. And so just to make it clear, the guideline doesn't say that, it doesn't just say that you should use tetrabenazine. Mm-hmm. It says that you should use tetrabenazine or Ryutec or amantadine. And then it goes on to explain the magnitude of benefit that you can expect to see or that we know of from the different drugs, the side effects that you need to be worried about that are going to influence which of the drugs that you choose, whether we know whether there's a long-term benefit. And so the guideline itself goes into a lot more of the nuances. It does say should prescribe, and the reason it says should is that we have three levels of obligation that are roughly linked to the quality of the evidence. And so those levels are must, you must do this, and then something softer, you should do this, and then something even softer than that, that I think that you actually suggested, you may or you might do that.
Okay.
And because of the quality of the evidence was moderately strong, we use the word should. That's been shown that physicians can interpret that as somewhat in between. It's not as strong as a must. It's not as strong as a should. Now, you know, we're stuck with words, and sometimes mm-hmm. We don't have the words that always have the correct nuances. But I have to say, it doesn't say should take tetrabenazine. It gives a whole list of medications where we have moderately strong evidence, and then it goes into all the nuances that would
right.
go into choosing that evidence. Where we do struggle, and I guess I put struggle in quotes, is when there's no evidence at all, or very little evidence, or very weak evidence, and that is the case with the neuroleptics. Many of the strong drugs that are commonly used to treat chorea, there's really a paucity of good evidence, and that doesn't mean, and certainly in the patient summary documents and in the physician documents, that doesn't mean that your physician shouldn't use a neuroleptic. It's going to be, we have less confidence in the effectiveness of those drugs because there's less evidence. They may turn out to be very effective, and as Dr. Goodman mentioned, there's a head-to-head trial ongoing, which may cause us to revise the guideline when that's published. And so physician experience also plays a role in this, but our purpose here is to summarize the evidence and to let physicians and patients know what the evidence is telling us about what works.
Very good.
And I'd like to add one thing to that. There is, you mentioned about some of the guidelines coming out of clinical experience, and one approach we take when we're looking at the evidence for the guidelines is we don't come to it with any preconceived notions about which drugs we should look at and which drugs are irrelevant. When we use the librarian and try to find all of the relevant evidence, we looked at any possible study that we could find that involved Huntington's disease patients and involved treatment of chorea. And that could have been the main point of the study, or it could have been something that they looked at in a study for a different reason. And then we analyzed the evidence for the effect of the drug on chorea, regardless of whether it's something we usually use in clinic or not. And so some of the drugs that we looked at the evidence for are not drugs that are routinely used by physicians to treat chorea. But if we found an article that addressed it, we looked at it because we wanted to be comprehensive in what we analyzed.
Perfect. And we're listening to Dr. Armstrong, Melissa Armstrong. Thank you. I really appreciate you jumping in there. And, you know, you are the author of the guideline along with Dr. Janice Miyasaki. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, so tell us about the development, the guideline development process, and you're in the guideline development subcommittee. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So how, take us like from beginning through the process to when you publish.
So you don't have to be a member of the Guideline Development Subcommittee to work on a guideline. I happen to be an author on this guideline and a member of the Guideline Development Subcommittee, but I worked on guidelines even before I became a member of the subcommittee. And anyone can nominate a potential guideline topic, but topics must then be approved by the Guideline Development Subcommittee. Once approved, a guideline panel without relevant conflicts of interest is developed to systematically obtain the evidence, rate the evidence, and then develop recommendations based on the strength of the evidence. Sometimes these panels are very small. There's always at least two people because every article has to be reviewed by at least two people to make sure that there's agreement to try to minimize the bias in rating the articles. Sometimes panels are larger than that. Then in general, once a guideline is drafted based on the evidence, it's reviewed by the Guideline Development Subcommittee, sometimes multiple times, and then as Dr. Gronseth mentioned, it's then reviewed by a number of other neurologists, specialists, other AAN committees, and the Neurology Journal Editorial Board. So it starts with a question, an approval of the question. Then it goes through obtaining the evidence, rating the evidence, and then developing recommendations from the evidence. And then there are a lot of checks on that system to make sure that the evidence is rated accurately and that reasonable recommendations are derived from the evidence.
Okay, so then once the evidence is obtained and analyzed, then you develop the guidelines based on the evidence.
That's right.
Okay. So here's a question from one of our guests in the audience. Why would the HDSA question the AAN's recommendations, especially if the AAN is the go-to with regards to neurological diseases? And then will you be retracting the statement or updating the statement?
Well, I can address this first, and then we can see if Dr. Gronseth has additional comments.
Okay.
But I think we can discuss in a moment that I do think that we have more similarities than disagreements in many of the details. But the approach from the HDSA is a bit different from the AAN approach. So as Dr. Gronseth mentioned earlier, there are different ways to develop guidelines. The AAN develops evidence-based guidelines, and that's the process in place for the guideline process for the academy. And that means that sometimes, even when things are used clinically, we can't find the evidence to support them, and we say that in the guideline. And the HDSA, they have provided a book that's excellent. It's called The Physician's Guide to the Management of HD Symptoms. And it discusses treatments for chorea and Huntington's disease. You can also access an algorithm for treatment of chorea in Huntington's disease. Those, both the book and the algorithm, were developed with different Huntington's disease experts. And they're based on expert opinion or expert survey results. And so they developed that approach in a different way. We looked purely at the evidence. They certainly consider the evidence because experts base their treatment decisions on evidence, but also on clinical experience. And so these approaches are different, but both have value. We just approach the process somewhat differently. And that's
different
where a lot of the differences come in.
Yeah, different parameters for different recommendations.
And we don't have plans to retract the guideline because the guideline follows the process at the AAN. And we do feel that there is value in an evidence-based guideline. And that kind of guideline can give us information that's different than the information that expert opinion gives us. And it's good to consider them as complementary approaches. So we stand by the way that the AAN develops guidelines, even while we recognize that in other contexts there is value of certainly value to expert opinion as well.
Okay, here's a we're getting some questions coming in and comments coming in, so bear with me here. Okay, first one is Judy Robertson. Realizing that most people are being treated for HD by either primary care physicians or neurologists who are not HD experts, there's a concern that they might be treated with TBZ or tetrabenazine due to these guidelines that are not fully endorsed by the HD experts and HDSA. Is that something that you're concerned about?
Well, I think it's important that when there's been some concern that doctors might make decisions based solely on the abstract of the guideline. So an abstract is a brief summary that occurs at the beginning of a published journal article. And the difficulty with that is that most journals, including neurology, limit the word count of these summaries. So in the allowed space, there simply isn't enough room to capture all of the important details of an article or a guideline. So it's really important that doctors treating Huntington's patients read the whole guideline, or if it's a research article, read the whole research article to fully understand when the guideline is applicable and to whom it should be applied. And in the context of the Huntington's disease chorea guideline, many of the concerns voiced are addressed in a section towards the end of the article called clinical context. And in this section, we mention that it's important that patients decide individually with their doctor about what treatment is right for them. We also point out, as Dr. Goodman did, that the clinical trials in Huntington's are done in a very select group of fairly healthy Huntington's patients, and the results might not be applicable to everyone with HD. We also mention in that section that neuroleptics, or as they're also known, antipsychotics, are the most commonly prescribed drug in Huntington's for chorea and for other symptoms based on some survey results. And doctors may choose to prescribe these medications to treat multiple symptoms at the same time. For example, if someone has chorea and behavioral problems. So these kinds of nuances are captured in the full original article and in some of the extra material published by the AAN for both patients and doctors. And if your listeners want to look at these summaries, there are patient summaries and clinician summaries and other materials. They can all be accessed on the AAN guideline website, which is aan.com/guidelines.
Okay, very good. And then for patients, you know, a lot of this clinical stuff is a little more, it's more difficult for the layman to understand. They can access information at aan.com/patients. Now, is there a simpler form of this guideline or an explanation of it?
We do. So when we publish a guideline, the AAN publishes additional materials that go along with it. Because it is, you know, it's a full-length research article, and it can be a lot to read through. And because it directly affects patients, we want to make sure that they understand what it says as well.
Okay.
So in addition to the full guideline that's published in the journal, the AAN publishes summaries, and there's one summary for physicians that summarizes the results and some of the nuances with the results as well. And then there's one page for patients. It's actually, a three-page document that discusses Huntington's, discusses the different drugs that we looked at, and summarizes in layman's terms or patient's terms what the guideline says. And some of the nuances, what it says, what we couldn't say, the importance of talking to your doctor, and things like that.
Okay, so we can go to www.aan.com/patient and find this guide.
That's right.
James, is that the one that you just posted? I think he's muted. I think he just posted it on...
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Okay, now here's another couple of comments. Bear with me. Okay, what if the PCP, or primary care physician, or non-expert neurologist is not familiar with the other sources other than the AAN? Is the AAN willing to post comments such as the physician's guide and HDSA have on their own guidelines? I'm not sure.
I'll be honest, I don't know the answer to that. I think that the Huntington's disease community is very savvy, and certainly the Huntington's Disease Society of America has a huge impact on patients and their families and clinicians. And so I imagine that most physicians will know that there are multiple resources that they can use when treating HD patients. The HDSA is one excellent resource. There are some others as well, and the AAN is another resource. I think that most physicians will know there is more than one option,
right.
And certainly patients can be aware that there are different societies, different guidelines, and different options out there.
Very good. Do we have any other comments or questions up there, James? Oh, where to get AAN summary versus physician's guide. Okay, so the AAN summary is on the AAN.com/patients. Is that correct?
So I believe that AAN.com/patients has different information about Huntington's for patients, including the summary of the guidelines. And then AAN.com/guidelines has all of the different guideline materials, the guideline itself, the summary for clinicians, the summary for patients, and even some other materials like a PowerPoint presentation.
Oh, very good. So you can probably hold a CME lecture with this information too.
It's certainly, the PowerPoint could certainly be a starting point for presenting the results of the guidelines.
Okay. Now, is that something that AAN is working on? Is CME or continuing medical education credit for physicians and clinicians?
So the neurology journal has CME related to every issue,
okay.
But not every article is directly linked into the neurology CME program.
Oh.
So that I don't know if the HD guideline was linked to CME in that issue. The print issue is still yet to come out.
Very good. Okay. I think we have, let's see if we have any other questions real quick here. I'm going to look. James, do we have any other questions posted?
Melissa, do you mind if
go ahead,
if I close? Yes, I'm sorry. If I close the loop on a previous question,
Sure.
Dr. Armstrong answered the question about retraction, but there was a question about updating, and
yes.
And we definitely do update our guidelines on a
okay.
regular basis
okay.
based on new evidence. And so the article that Dr. Goodman described, the randomized controlled trial comparing tetrabenazine to the antipsychotic type medications, and when that's published, depending on the results and how well it's done, very likely you'll see an update to this guideline.
Okay, very good. Let's see, we have one more question or comment. It looks like from Judy again. Hi, Judy. Okay, she says, it'd be nice if the AAN could tweak their guideline rules to accommodate complex situations like this one. I don't know what that means. Maybe you do.
So I don't disagree with that statement. Virtually all the clinical situations that we're dealing with are quite complex, and we try to explain that complexity, but it never seems to be exactly enough in any document that you write. So I don't disagree. In terms of tweaking the rules, the rules are there primarily to reduce the risk of bias. And so there's a long history of expert opinion being incorrect, and there's a long history of expert opinion being correct too, and we don't have good rules for figuring that out. We
right.
do have very good rules for figuring out when evidence is more likely to be correct, And so we take this perspective for that reason. We can tell whether we can be confident in the evidence. We can't tell so much when we can be confident in expert opinion, but boy, when it gets down to making decisions for an individual patient, it's the judgment of the experts, and it's knowing their patients and the individual circumstances of their patients becomes very, very important, and much more important than any guideline.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And the should and may language is based on your evidence, right?
That's correct. If we're moderately confident in the evidence, we typically use the word should.
Very good. Well, do we have anything else that we need to let our listeners know about how your process works?
I think you asked excellent questions today, and we really appreciate the opportunity to come on the air and explain how the AAN approaches this.
Well, it's all kind of new stuff to some of us, to a lot of us. And I'm sure there's going to be additional questions. I hope that we can come back and have you on the show again if we have additional information or questions to pose to you. And I appreciate the fact that you've taken time out of your busy schedules to come on the show and explain some things to us. So thank you, both of you, Dr. Gronstedt and Dr. Armstrong. And everyone at the AAN, appreciate you coming on the show. James, did you have any other questions out there for us?
No, it just seems that, I think it's going to sink in. And if we do have any additional questions, I know that we'll definitely get with the AAN.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you, everyone, for an
Thank
awesome
you.
Show. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.